Rodney Dillard is a legend. He's my guest in the second hour. You've heard of the Dillards if you've ever listened to this program. Maybe if the first time you're tuning in tonight, you probably still know the Dillards. You may know the Darling family from the Andy Griffith Show. That was them plus two character actors. Great band. They influenced so much music on the West Coast. They left for Missouri. They went to California. All kinds of great things happened to them. College crowds, folk music, country rock, I think, drew so many benefits and so many ideas from the Dillards. You're going to want to listen to Rodney Dillard, the last Dillard standing. My guest today on Unreal Bluegrass, I'm so happy to finally get the opportunity to talk to Rodney Dillard. How are you, Rodney?
I'm fine, Steve, my fellow Earth man. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. This is so great. The Dillards, listen, I have to do this a little bit because the Dillards played such a role in so many kinds of music. I have the albums. The very first album I bought was the Back Porch Fiddle, and I forget the full name. Back Porch, I got the LP. I can prove it to you. Fell in love with that sound, and the Dillards have influenced so many bands and types of music, and you were probably the first, and I say you meaning the Dillards, you guys played so many college shows, and you brought in a lot of folk music, which shows up in some of your recordings that we can talk about. You were doing Polly Vaughan, you were doing things that weren't originally maybe bluegrass, but you took them in and made them great songs for the Dillards. The Dillards, we're going to explore this in detail, a band in Missouri, you wind up in California, and all of a sudden you're on TV, and it's just the whole thing happened so quickly. You were in the perfect spot, and you had the perfect goods to be able to deliver. But I'm telling you, the Dillards are just a part of American music history, in my opinion. I think a lot of people.
Well, it was amazing how that happened. You know, we live about, I guess we're, the Ozark Mountains about 5.5 hours from Nashville. And we used to go down quite a bit to go to the Opry and see Flat Screws and different things when I was a kid. And we decided to go to L.A. because nobody, I think, out there was really listening to that kind of music much. It was Town Hall Party and some of those people. And it was Western kind of music. And so we decided to go there because at the time I felt that Nashville, I used to make a joke about their dials at the time on the boards were rusted to the same place all the time because stuff started to sound very much like itself.
I like that.
And so we went out there just – I tell you, we left here. This is the kind of faith we had, or just dumbness. We left here in a 55 Cadillac and a one-wheel trailer. And that one-wheel trailer that my mom had baked a turkey for us because it was the day before Thanksgiving when we left. And we put that all together and we started traveling. We had $9.60 between us. Of course, being from the Ozarks, we weren't used to large sums of money like that. We ran through it in about a month. But we got as far as Oklahoma City, ran out of everything, and got stuck there doing odd jobs. You know, we'd go down to Manpower, and I think we were on TV there more than we have ever been because they were always the news would come out, and there would be unloading license plates, or there would be setting up voting machines. It was all the local news stuff, so we'd be watching ourselves.
Well, or at least you were unloading license plates and not making them.
Yes, that was very fortunate for us. But and that's where we met Byron Berline. And later on, of course, we brought him out to L.A. and cut that third album with him, Picking and Fiddling. But anyway, we made enough money in a folk club there to get us to California. And I'll make this as short as possible and still keep it interesting if I can. When we got out there, we checked into the Melrose Motel, one of the cheapest hotels you can get that they rented by the minute, I think. And we went into a place called the Ash Grove because we had heard about it. It was the petri dish of the intellectual folk crowd. With, you know, that you talk about oil and water. Woo! Here I came out of the Ozarks. And first thing, you know, I walked in that door when we just first got there, and a guy said, no, it was a lady. Her name was Dodge, I believe. Some for the Dodge people. And she says, well, what do you think of the existentialist dilemma? I said, I don't know. I was raised Presbyterian. And she sort of pumped and walked off. And we gave her an honest answer. I didn't know. Anyway, we picked up our instruments out and started playing right there in the lobby of the Ash Grove, which is now the Comedy Store. And the fella who owned it walked up and said, you can't do that here. He said, do it on stage. And I think at the time, I'm not sure it was either Johnny Cash or another famous duo. I can't remember. We went up there, and evidently we tore it up, walked off. A representative for Jack Holzman's Elektra Records was there. Andy's agency, the William Morris agency, was there. We made a deal to make a deal with the William Morris agency and Elektra Records that night. Isn't that weird?
I mean nobody. You guys must have thought this is so easy. You go to California and you get a record deal and a TV deal, and it's not even time to go to bed yet.
And you know what? Boy, was that a false start, because it was not like that at all later. But yes, and so they put an ad in the paper that said, in Variety, that the Elektra Records has signed these weird looking guys from the Ozarks and play this really weird kind of mountain music, and because California, they didn't know. And Andy saw that, and he had a script on his desk called "The Darlins Are Coming." He said, call these boys up and bring them over. Let's see what they got. We went over there into Desi Lu Studios, fresh out of the Ozarks, walking in where all these stars were doing their stuff. And, of course, in Hollywood, they were at the time always interested in what was new or what was weird, you know. Oh, here come some hillbillies. Let's finger poke them. They quaint. So here we walked into where he was doing they were cutting something at the time. They were filming one of the videos. I think it was where Barney was singing off in the choir, one of those episodes.
When he was the clinker. He was singing the clinker part, and he couldn't figure out, and he was trying to help Andy.
That was right.
Yep, I remember.
That's right. And anyway, Andy pulled up their folding chairs. He and Bob Sweeney, the director, said, okay, show us what you got. Well, we started picking, and about halfway through Ruben's Train, he slapped his knees and said, that's it. I turned to my brother and said, Douglas, they're kicking us out. Got enough to leave. He says, where are you going? You got the job. Well, we were only supposed to do one of those episodes, but they had so many cards and letters come in that represented – it became a hit on that show. And here we are still, naive young people, just still didn't understand what was going on really, but just having a lot of fun on that show. And so it just, you know, it became one of the most popular shows. I'm not trying to be arrogant.
Oh,
but
I know it is.
Stating the fact, And it's continued on. That show's never been off the air. But here's the funny, not funny, but weird. We had another career as the Dillards, not just the Dumbface Darlins. But we had this whole college. We started hitting the college circuit when we did TV shows like Hootenanny and all those shows at the time, the folk shows. I remember doing 32 concerts in 30 days.
Jeez.
And, of course, we were all young and healthy then. So we really got that circuit, but later on we signed to do 7 Judy Garland shows when she came back on the CBS.
I've seen clips of that.
And it was a weird, it was scary. If I hadn't done the Andy Griffith show before that, I think I would have just headed to home. Because that was very scary and intense and weird. Mel Torme was music director. George Slaughter, I think, was the director, because he went on to create Laugh-In. And
but think about it. Just stop for a second and think about it. Here you are with Judy Garland, and you're playing the music from the Ozarks and the bluegrass music, and you're playing to a world that was tuning in to see Judy Garland, and now they're seeing and hearing the impact of that. And the Andy Griffith shows where the Darlings came to town and the Darlings were doing this. Those things were incredible, and they're probably the most favorite episodes of a lot of people that I know. They look for the episodes of Andy Griffith with the Darlings because they know it's the Dillard, not the dad, not the sister, but everybody knows who you are now. But just think of the incredible impact that you had and all the bluegrass that you put out to so many different audiences.
Yeah, who'd never heard it before. Well, that gave us the opportunity to start working places at the time. Now, younger folks won't know what this means, but there was a club in San Francisco called the Hungry Eye. And everybody worked that club from, you name it. That was what you did. You had to work that place. That was a sign of achievement. We did a month at the Hungry Eye, and we had different openers. Ronnie Schell he was a comedian and did Gomer Pyle USMC and all these.
I know exactly. As soon as you said his name, and then I know exactly. I see his picture.
Yeah, we had a lot of other those folks that worked with us. And, of course, then we go to New York and work the Bitter Inn and other places. and working places that nobody else, even country people, weren't involved in, because we brought this humor with us that wasn't the blacked out teeth kind of burlesque humor, but it was a different kind of humor we brought. And of course, I played the foil at the time, and so we brought it in a different way that gave people another perspective on the Ozarks, other than just the Judy Garland hat on the head, sitting in a yard with jugs and chasing your sister.
Well, let me ask you this, Rodney. I want to talk about Earthman, because that is the single that the audience just heard. But before we get off of this TV, when people would see the Darlings, which were the Dillards plus the dad and the sister, you guys had this very, very straight face. There was no smiling. There was no – was that directed to you, or did you decide to take that image into the studio with you? I mean, you were just deadpan.
That was directed.
Okay. It was hysterical. It was hysterical to watch.
He did that, yeah, but Daryl and my other brother Daryl came out of that. The reason they did it, I think it was probably smart on their part, and also they wouldn't have to pay us as actors if we spoke.
That's probably it. Don't give them any lines. That's
the great thing about this is, and I want to reflect on Andy, because he was very good to us on that show, just incredible. He came to us and he said, "Now, boys," he says, "you're not going to make much money as actors on this show." And he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do." He said, "Cause at that time there was no residuals for actors." He said, "I'll get as many of the songs you write on the show as I can." And that, of course, never ends. That's perpetual. You know.
That's right, because you have the rights to them.
Oh, all the songs?
Yeah.
Dewey, There Is a Time, all the other ones.
Oh, man.
Marie, yeah. And he did that for – he could have done Public Domain and not paid anything and took all the claims. But he did not do that.
Yeah.
And he – that's how – we have an average of 4 or 5 before they started cutting up the epilogues, you know. And it's been, what, 60 years. 60-year anniversary coming up at – Mayberry Days, if we can make it up there to Mount Airy.
Oh, do you go back every year?
Every year.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, I'm so happy to be talking to Rodney Dillard, and Rodney's telling the stories that I want to hear about the Dillards and their TV involvement. And so we just did mention this. It's right there. There actually isn't a town called Mayberry, is there? There's a Pilot Mountain.
There's Mayberry Mills up the road before, and there's Pilot Mountain, mm-hmm. and then – of course, Andy King from Mount Airy. His house is still there. And it was so strange. I was sitting out there with Andy's friend, Emmett, because he used that image on his show, Emmett's Fix-A-Chop. Yeah. And here I am sitting out there with Emmett watching a car show, sitting on a bench on the main street of Mayberry and going, "Mom, this feels like Mayberry." Really?
Rodney, let's back up a little bit. We've heard Earthman. That's a new single. I want you to talk a little bit about that. That release that the audience heard right as we began talking.
Well, I'll tell you, I wish I'd have written that song, but a friend of mine, Bob Millsap, wrote that song, and he wrote several hits, one for George Jones called She's My Rock and I Ain't Gonna Throw Her Away. He wrote Heaven Is My Woman's Love for Tommy Overstreet, and 2 or 3 of his hits, and he came up here to bring, and of course, he published a song called You Needed Me by Ed Murray. And we became friends and did a lot of fishing together. He built a studio here in Branson, which years later I took over. But he had written a song and asked me if I'd do a demo on it for him. And I did. He says, well, he had written a book called Earthman, and this was a song about it. And so it sat in my library down here on cassette for 30-some-odd years. And when I got ready to do this album, I started going through things that I really thought to me had meaning, not just Moon, Spoon, June, you know, lost my baby and now I'm sad and all that. So I wanted to put this album together that would bookend Wheatstraw Suite, because at my age, you don't know what you got. You know, nobody knows what their time is. And I started putting together songs that I felt maybe said something and maybe gave people encouragement and hope. And I never do want to do the Donnie Downer stuff, you know. And so this album came together like that. And this song, my wife, Beverly Cotton, pulled it up and said, you know, you need to do this. I said, you're right. So that was one of the first songs we did. Then we got into other things similar to that. One of them, which I may release the next one is called Tearing Our Liberty Down. And Skaggs sings that one with me as a duet.
So you might have this. We'll just kind of let the audience speculate. You may have some more tunes coming out that might be attached to this Earthman song.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Yes, indeed. And since it's all changed, the way music is produced to the people or given to the people is so much different than it used to be, since it's all a digital age now, and everything has changed the whole paradigm of the way we exist on the planet. And, here we are, Earthman, just passing through, looking for just love and truth. You know, what goes beyond that is all speculation and rhetoric.
Boy, don't we know that now more than ever before.
You are right. You're right.
Who would have ever dreamed, but that's where we are now.
Yeah, so we just have to, what do we have to do? We just kind of have to just go with it. And hopefully we have developed enough decent values that where it isn't just I, me, to really realize that we are all here on this planet together. We're stewards, you know?
Yeah, that's the hard thing to get through to people, Rodney, is that, we're short-timers compared to the life of the planet and the age of the planet. We're just kind of passing through. Yeah. I think that's the best way to put it. You know, you were a vocalist, guitar player. You also played dobro with the Dillard.
Yeah, I've got my I have another dobro, Rudy Jones dobro. I've always wanted one, and the guy who took over the company from him, he passed, sent me one the other day. So I'm getting back into it. But I played on sessions in Hollywood for Keith Carradine and the Association, Linda Ronstadt, and people like that. And I used to dobro on some of those sessions.
Well, and one of my favorite tunes, because of we had a band. We did several Dillard's tunes, by the way. There Is a Time, and of course you have to do Dooley, which was so advanced for what Doug was playing. It's even the part of Banjo in the Hollow, that every banjo player listening will know that after you learn Cripple Creek, if you're really cool, you sneak in a lick from Banjo in the Hollow because it fits right into Cripple Creek. But
it's very interesting, and I like the brain of my brother a little bit, Bill Keith. The great, yes, who started the whole chromatic thing, said he was inspired by Douglas's Banjo in the Hollow.
I think that's exactly right. I think exactly, yeah. The melodic style, I think you're right, and he did it on. And Dooley is kind of creeps up and down the neck, different roles and stuff like that.
He would incorporate that stuff, and he didn't know at the time that was an approach to chromatic. He was just kind of playing what he felt. Just like Earl Scruggs told me, we toured together for a while there, and I did an album with him on Columbia. And he would tell me, he said, well, when I got my banjo, he said, it was an instrument. I wasn't trying to play bluegrass. I was just playing music.
That's right.
You're not limited like that, and you're not editing yourself. Therefore, the creativity of what you do can just kind of fly, let it fly.
That's right. And the reason that I came back to this dobro question is I was mentioning the cover tunes that we used to play is Traveling Dobro Blues.
Yeah.
That was one that the dobro player, he wanted to play that in the worst way, and I won't say that he played it in the worst way, but he didn't play it as good as you did. But so that was one I was very familiar with, is the Traveling Dobro Blues.
That was our first concert at Washington University.
Yes, it was.
And I was scared to death. I was just a kid. I was so nervous at Washington University. Boy, they're going to know everything.
Listen, I want to come back and talk to you some more, but I want you to introduce, and I think that what you want to introduce at this point is Nobody Knows, and I want you to filter in some of the Dillard's tunes. There's so many things, Rodney, we could talk about. The creation of the Dillard's, how they progressed through the 60s, their impact on so many Americana or American country rock bands. It was just all over the place. But I want to bring you back, and I want you to introduce a tune. I think it's Nobody Knows is what we wanted to go to.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you get to introduce it. You're the band guy.
Oh, well, I do it now? Okay.
Nobody
was something that Mitch and I did a lot. We wrote 40 songs together. And we just get together and write and fight and fuss and eye gouge and crotch kick and come up with these songs, and because we never agreed on everything, our philosophical differences were pretty wide, and but we came out with this stuff, and we wrote this one. I think I had seen the James Bond film, and I can't remember what it was there. somewhere in Hollywood. And I thought, wow, I'm going to write this song. So we started writing it together, and hints came, Nobody Knows, and Nobody Do Day.
Nobody Knows But The Shadow.
Yes, the shadow do.
That's right. Let's hear Nobody Knows from the Dillards, and I'll be back, and we'll talk to Rodney some more. All right, hold on.
All right.
Oh, there you just heard Nobody Knows. Yeah. Thank you, Rodney, for introducing that with James Bond. I didn't connect it with a James Bond movie, but I'm so happy to get to talk to you some more. Say again?
I said, I don't know how I did.
Oh, well, but you did. And you were able to remember that you did.
Yes. That was the one that's got the flutes and the orchestra on it. And that was so much fun getting together with the guy who wrote the parts and humming those things. See, I don't read music at all. And at the time, I've learned it just a little bit, but I would hum the parts to these arrangers out there, and they would lay them down. And if they didn't work, they'd say, well, you can't do this. You can't do that.
The Dillards that we might recognize from those early Andy Griffith shows and also just from the early albums, it was you, your brother, Doug, phenomenal, innovative banjo player that still inspires us all, and Dean Webb.
Dean Webb, yeah. He was in a little town called Lone Jack, which is not too far from where Truman grew up there in Independence, Missouri.
And you mentioned Mitch James right as we went into that song talking about traveling. He introduces you as I forget how he describes a dobro, but it's something I've never heard before.
Yeah, if it's Mitch, it's something that nobody heard before.
That's right. So how long did you play together as a band before you decided to head west, young man, and find your fortune?
Oh, not very long enough. Of course, Douglas and I made records together when I was still in high school. In fact, Banjo and Hollow was cut first on a what was the name? Oh, K-Arc Records, a guy out of St. Louis. And we went into a little studio in Belleville, Illinois, Doug and I did, and we recorded Banjo on the Holla and another song on the other side, and then another tune which nobody's ever heard called Doug's Breakdown. And it's really a neat tune, but it was never re-recorded, so nobody got to hear it.
Well, but somebody has to record it and release it. Rodney, brother of Doug, I think it might be something you need to take on.
You learn it.
Listen, we could break this down by year segments of what the Dillards did. But here's what I wanted to ask you. Doug was an influence on so many banjo players. You had to think of playing a guitar based on someone that you saw or heard playing a guitar. And I haven't asked you that yet, but I want to know, why did you play guitar?
Well, my dad played old-time fiddle. He was a fiddle player. It was that old-timey, like Tommy Gerald, those old mountain guys. He was from Tennessee. And he got Douglas a banjo, an old K banjo. And I can remember he got it for Christmas, and Doug went out and immediately took a magnifying glass and burned his initials on the inside of the resonator. And I think what he was doing was putting together his own band, and then he got me a guitar, an old silver tune.
Well, these are great names. My first banjo was a K. The strings were about an inch and a half high off of the fretboard, but I didn't know they weren't supposed to be that high.
He's greater.
Silvertone was a Sears instrument, right?
That's exactly right. Funny thing about it, I'll tell the story. My mother played guitar, and the way she taught us to get interested in that was she put it behind the couch, and then she'd say, because it was in the corner, and she'd say, now, while I'm gone, you guys don't touch that guitar. But that's how I got started playing the rhythm, and then I got interested in some of the local people, just local guys, just woodcutters and people like that who played really good, you know, played well. You know, there's so many pickers in the mountains that you never hear of, and I learned to play that heavy lick, and Billy Strings plays like that too. It's almost like a rock and roll rhythm.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Good point.
It isn't just dog leg rhythm like sometimes you hear, boom shakalaka laka boom diggity. You know, I call that dog leg rhythm.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
But Billy Strings had that same kind of enthusiastic and has approach. I like what he does, and because it's like a bluegrass rock and roll attitude.
Well, he's been on the show before, and I featured Billy in the program, and he was a rock and roll girl. He was a headbanger.
Yeah, but so we started playing, Doug, of course, played, and I had to play because Doug always played right on the front of the beat, you know, and you really had to play to keep up with him, and still keep not just a thud chuck rhythm, but actually accent it with backbeats with your hands. So I developed a pretty strong hand that way, and then we did the album with Byron. I started playing these syncopated licks because he played that Oklahoma style, but that's how I got started on that, okay. You know.
Here's a tune that I will venture that half of the people listening to this program may not recognize. I do because I was listening to it back then. But if you say Old Home Place, they're all going to think of J.D. Crow, and that's a great version. But Old Home Place was, and when you listen to the words, clearly it's from your neck of the woods. The tune that people, and you go back and listen to it, and Doug is playing it. And I love J.D. Crow, but I'm thinking he didn't vary too much from what Doug had laid down on the banjo track.
Well, everybody has their gift and their way of presenting their music, and I respect that, you know. And Skaggs and those guys did a great job on that.
Oh, yeah.
And then I just heard another version. Doc Watt, he did a Never See My Home Again, I'm sorry. But there was a super band with Rice and all those guys that did Old Home Place.
It pops up every couple of albums. Somebody will do it, but it was a Dillard's tune, and I have to remind people sometimes that that's where that song came from.
Yeah. I was playing somewhere in a theme park, a concert thing, and one of the people who played there went to the entertainment director and said, "Hey, we're doing that song. They can't do that song." But there it is. But yeah, Old Home Place was that. That's kind of it. Really reflects the attitude of some of the people like out of Arkansas and Missouri who went to the big cities to try to make some money and buy a car or a truck on payment and then go back and show everybody how successful we were and then have it taken away 3 months later because they couldn't pay for it.
Right.
And that was kind of the way the rural people who decided they wanted to move away and not do farming and do that and go to the city. And a lot of bluegrass, that stuff came. There was a lot of second-generation country people, like around St. Louis, where Doug and I used to play a lot because there was a lot of bars, Doug and I and John Hartford. And, that was the culture then, those people that tried to better their lives by moving to the city.
That was thought to be, I'm talking to Rodney Dillard if you're just tuning in, that was thought to be the progression. That was thought to be the next step up. Maybe wasn't really quality of life, but that was the natural thing to do. There were so many people that left my state of Kentucky to head to the automobile manufacturing plants in Detroit and also in Ohio.
That's exactly right. Ozark, Fisher Body, and they up here in St. Louis, mm-hmm. And saw factories in different places. But yeah, that was the movement then. You know, if you wanted to do a cultural explanation of how this music has progressed, where it came from. Some guy wanted to write a book. Well, I guess there's been a lot of books written on that. But, you know, we used to call country music flatland music.
I did not know that.
Because it was all about bars and stuff. If you look at old country music, it's all unrequited love.
Yeah. Okay.
It's on in a different perspective.
Yeah.
But it always reflects the culture of the times, and you can't always go back and do that again. Like the new players, the young players, they love the old stuff, but you can't recapture that feel again. You can try. Very few maybe do that, but it's very difficult.
Rodney, they can try, and they can try, but they didn't live it. It's not in their bones. Is kind of a cliche way of saying it, but they didn't grow up two or three generations. They can go back and visit it, and they can try to absorb as much as they can, but it's not the same. It's not in their genes.
Yeah, I don't want to offend anybody, but you get a young kid out of New Jersey can't sing Delta Blues.
Yeah.
Dang it, but it's...
It doesn't have that gut. It doesn't have that guttural feel to it. They're trying, and they mean to try it, but it's not the same.
They respect it, but, yeah. You know, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
I sound like an old man, do I?
That's okay. Both of us do, but I think there's a kernel of truth in what we're trying to convey back and forth. And it's not a knock. Like you say, it's not a knock. It's just that you can't be what you can't be. You can learn it, but you can't be what you can't be.
That's right. Like Earth Man says, we're just looking for a little bit of love and truth.
That's right. That's right.
Gravel like a chicken in the yard.
That's right. That's right. You, one of my favorite tunes that you guys, let's do this. Your Beatles tunes. You guys were recording Beatles tunes. You did an acapella yesterday, and I play it in the show every once in a while because it fits right in with the program that I'm doing. But no music. You're not doing the gospel acapella. You're doing modern songs then.
You know how that song came about?
No.
The big studio where they cut all this, the pre-records for the big network variety shows at the time, and they bring all the orchestrations in and stuff. And we were just there in this old huge room around this microphone waiting for the engineer to get something together, and we just impromptu sang that.
Really?
Singing. We were all around one microphone, and we just I had to kick it up because I was singing lead. And I loved the early Beatles like that. I loved the Rubber Soul album.
Yeah.
And so we just started singing, and we did it. John Boylan was produced that. He produced a lot of hits for people. I think he produced Boston. So. Anyway, and Linda Ronstadt. But he said, hey, let's put that down. So we did it again, and that was it.
Really? It was that quick?
Yeah. It was that quick. Just like Single Saddle was off the Wheat Straw Sweet album.
Wow.
We were just goofing around talking about the old days, and Herb said, well, I really like this song. Mom Monroe had the original cut on it. He just started doing it, and we recorded it. It wasn't planned. It was not planned.
How are you doing these days, Rodney? We talked a little bit about the times we live in, which everybody knows, but how are you doing?
Well, I still have the farm in Missouri, 150-acre farm that was it's been in the family since 1865, and it's down in the Ozarks, and I got a guy who's a caretaker who takes care of it. I live in Branson, Missouri, and I've been here 30-some-odd years, and I love it here. Right now, as I'm speaking to you, I'm looking at both of my sliding glass doors on each side of my house, and I'm looking at a lake that's 360 miles of shoreline.
Wow. What lake is that?
It's called Table Rock Lake.
Okay.
And then right below it, there's a series of lakes dammed up. And below that one, I'm looking at the Trout Lake, which is called Taney County, Missouri, Taney Como. And it's one of the best trout. And I'm looking at five mountain ranges down into Arkansas.
Uh-huh. Nice vision. You have a nice peaceful vision out there.
I am blessed. I really, truly am. My backyard is full of deer, wild turkey, coyotes. You know, all the indigenous animals of the Ozarks. And I'm just blessed to be here and going through all the L.A. stuff and being on the road all those years and all over the world. I'm very happy with and I don't regret any of it, really. And, of course, I never had a hit record, but a lot of my friends did. So it's been a wonderful trip, I'll tell you. It sounds like I'm pitching my new album, but I really...
I want you to.
The album, and I hope somebody gets to hear it and, you know, find some redeeming social quality.
Well, I hope I get to hear it. You know, here's the thing, too. Okay, so if you can say you never had a hit record, however you define that, but look at the influence. You mentioned the Eagles. I know John McEwen. I know Byron was with you, and they took that influence other places. Look at this incredible, and it's still happening. It's still happening. I mentioned a little band that we used to play, several Dooley, There Is a Time. We're going to end with that tune. I want you to introduce it in a second. But
yes,
people are still mining those Dillard's tunes and all that great influence and just the way you guys went about it. And that's why those Andy Griffith shows are so popular. I know people that would buy a DVD set of Andy Griffith shows only if it has one of the Darlings episodes on it.
I don't know what to say. It's just amazing that the way our lives developed and what we did. A kid out of the Ozarks. I did try college, and I didn't care for it. Not because I didn't understand it, because I'd gotten scholarships. I mean, ranked the 97th percentile of the United States. And I just couldn't – it didn't wasn't for me. I just had this other thing that I wanted to do. I'm writing a book called Nuggets from the Horse I Rode In On. And I want to encompass that childhood feeling I had about music and what was on the other side of that mountain and what was there to life, like, you know, what I had going. And that was at a young age. And it just an incredible adventure for me to be able to do, and a gift from a higher power called God that really got me where I am. And I'm grateful for every second.
And the Dillards were a gift to all of us out here listening to music and picking up instruments and trying to play your music. I can tell you that. It's a very real thing. I'm glad that you chose the music because I love it. I love it so much. And all of my friends did. And once we really got into it, we realized the Dillards cut a path out west that was so important. There's so many great acoustic bluegrass players in California. Herb Peterson, you mentioned, he's just one of the many, and so much music, and then it spawns different, whole different kind of country, kind of southern rock, I don't mean the West Coast sound. And you guys were really the impetus for that. I believe that you were, because you were out there so early and had so much exposure so early. So you were gifted. We were gifted by what the Dillards did, is my opinion.
Well, I don't take any of it for granted, and I'm totally amazed. And I look back and I see that Led Zeppelin had been influenced by the Dillards, Elton John, and it just goes on. And it's just amazing to me. Albert Lee, you know, came in last time we played L.A., just came in and did two sets with me, you know, the guitar player.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just been incredible. I know, and I'm so happy for that. And I'm so happy that our lettuce in our garden is growing big. I got cabbage just about ready to eat.
How do you keep the deers out of your lettuce?
I have an Italian mastiff called, he's a Cane Corso.
Okay.
She is one big dude, yeah. And she will keep anything out of it. And I got a chain link fence in the back.
Okay.
And I got that up to keep me from falling off the mountain. But, it's the challenge.
Two things, Rodney. You mentioned you're writing a book. I need that when you're done. And okay. And we'll talk about that. And if you put everything together, including Earthman on a new CD, I want someone to give me that so we can talk again and play that music again.
I will make sure that Adrian gets you the next whatever release.
Sure.
The extended play. I'll give it to you early.
I'll be waiting for it. Listen, and then we want to talk about, well, I've mentioned the song several times, There Is a Time. And it was recorded recently, you reminded me, and I found the music from Alan Jackson. And maybe we can do an introduction of his version and then follow that with something from the Dillards. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah, Alan, evidently from what I can gather and from what I can hear from what he said in the New York Times, is that the Dillards, you know, the darlings on that show, inspired him. And, of course, that was one of his favorite songs on that. So when he decided to do a bluegrass album, he recorded it. He said some very nice – he was very gracious to us. And I do appreciate him for that. And he did a beautiful job of it. And all the players and everything. I was honored to hear that cut that he did.
Well, when I'm finished talking, it doesn't have to be right now, but when we're finished, we're going to play that version from Alan Jackson, and we're going to play a version from the Dillards of There Is a Time, which again was a song that we used to play in our band because it was just such a great, unique sound. And it was a great song. We don't compare to Alan Jackson. I'm not suggesting that, but I'm just saying the influence was pervasive. Look, you snagged Alan Jackson, and you snagged a bunch of guys who drove around and played for whoever would hear us play.
And you know what? To me, and this is going to sound weird, but it's anybody who felt like they wanted to, because I remember what it was like when Doug and I were snagging Flat and Scruggs teams, Bill Monroe, the Blue Sky Boys. We were doing that too on songs that we loved, and if any of our stuff affected people like those guys affected Doug and I in our career, that means a lot.
There was a lot of effect, and I'm just telling you, I can't tell you enough. I don't want to be repetitive, but there was a huge, huge effect from the Dillards, and I'm going to let you get back. I know you've got a nice view to look at. I'll say goodbye to you. We'll play Alan Jackson's version of There Is a Time, and then we'll put in a Dillard's version of There Is a Time. And on that, I will say goodbye to you now, Rodney Dillard. Thanks so much for being available, and we'll have to talk again.
Steve, thank you for your time and allowing us to be a part of that. And it's guys like you that perpetuate the music and the creativity end of it. And you're an encouragement to new people and people who want to say something different.
Well, on that, I will let you go. Thanks so much, Rodney Dillard.
Thank you, Steve. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye.